far-reaching knowledge was one of the secrets of Napoleon's predominance. But in naval matters, Napoleon was an amateur, not an expert. Napoleon got seasick when he was out on the water, and this led him to blunders that were unique in his career. An American inventor by the name of Robert Fulton came to Paris and offered the French two new inventions. One was a ship propelled by steam instead of by wind. The other was a submarine boat that could sink ships with torpedoes. Napoleon said that Robert Fulton was a charlatan. Why? Because Fulton was dealing with naval matters. If Fulton had brought Napoleon a machine gun and a field telegraph, Napoleon would have paid him well. But Napoleon failed to conquer England because this was the one area in which he was neither competent nor confident. If only he could have gotten to that English island by land. It is an island, and I don't know how much we over here think of it that way, but I think it's thought of that way in that area. Churchill said, "We will defend our island no matter what the cost may be." This is the way they thought of it, and that was a very important thing. The Roman Catholic maritime powers of France, Spain, Portugal, and Holland fought against Protestant England, and they were defeated. Every living soul in the sea died. They were annihilated in their character as European colonies. These wars that arose out of the French Revolution started in 1793 and lasted for more than two decades until 1815. The maritime power of England had long been separated from the papacy. England used to be the tenth part of the great city, as we saw back in chapter 11. Just a few dates to help us solidify this in our minds. In 1793, the greater part of the French fleet at Toulon was destroyed by Lord Hood. In 1794, the victory over the French by Lord Howe off of Ushant, which was a French island in the southwestern end of the English Channel. Also, the taking of Corsica and nearly all of the smaller Spanish and French West Indian islands. In 1795, the defeat of the French fleet of L'Orient, which was the flagship. Admiral Epistrone's taking of the Cape of Good Hope in this year as well. In 1797, the victory of the Spanish fleet, victory over the Spanish fleet off of Cape St. Vincent and over the Dutch off of Camperdown, which is off of Sydney, Australia. In 1798, Lord Nelson's victory of the Nile, where the flagship L'Orient was destroyed. In 1801, Lord Nelson's victory at Copenhagen, and in 1805, Nelson's annihilation of the French fleet at Trafalgar, which is off the coast of Spain. Lord Nelson was mortally wounded during this battle and died 3 hours later, but he became a great British hero. At Trafalgar Square in central London now, there is a very prominent statue of Lord Nelson, which undoubtedly some of you have seen. And we're talking about the things that happened on the water and on the ships. Eventually, Napoleon was taken by an English ship to the little island of St. Helena in the Atlantic, where he lived in exile for the remainder of his life. He apparently was slowly poisoned through his wine by one of the men who was with him there. We didn't know that until fairly recently by examining hair samples from his corpse just a few years ago. This was determined. How do you take a man who had been this vigorous and this gifted and suddenly he's in exile and he dies 6 years later in his early 50s? How does that happen? Apparently he was poisoned. In this naval war from 1793 to 1815, there were destroyed nearly 200 ships of the line, between 300 and 400 frigates, and almost an incalculable number of smaller vessels of war and ships of commerce. By this means, the world power of the papacy was tremendously weakened. This total destruction of the French marine and commercial power is even more remarkable because Napoleon knew how important it was, but he seemed to be impotent to do anything about it. He was all-powerful on land where he had to fulfill prophecy, but impotent in what the Lord's prophecy denied him. This war resulted in the loss to Papal France of the colonies in the West Indies and in South America, with Santo Domingo as an example. It's now Haiti, France had commerce which required 1,600 ships and 27,000 sailors just in that one place. All of this trade was lost to Papal France. Great Britain went into these revolutionary wars a dwarf and came out of them a giant. We go to the third bowl, which is poured out on the rivers and springs of water, and they became blood. This probably points to the Danube, the Rhine, and the Po rivers, and the hundreds of tributaries that flowed into them, and the surrounding territories involved with these rivers. In contrast to the maritime warfare of the Second Bowl, this suggests warfare on land near these rivers. As I mentioned the other day, the rivers were the freeways of this time, before the automobile. We say, "Where are you from I-80? They say, "Where are you from the Danube?" That was the mentality here. So the rivers were very, very important to them, much more so than the rivers are important to us now. These wars came about as a consequence of the French Revolution. Napoleon saw himself as the orderer of the chaos left behind by the Revolution. He took power in France, and using that as a base, he tried to consolidate a United States of Europe. Instead of the so-called legitimate monarchies of the divine rights of kings passing down their prerogatives hereditarily, Napoleon wanted talent to be supreme. That was true of Napoleon except where his own personal family was concerned. Napoleon gave every high office to his brothers, and his great goal was to produce an heir who could rule after him. It is said that Napoleon had no god but ambition. Napoleon was just as comfortable using the Pope as abusing the Pope. Napoleon could be a Muslim just as easily as a Catholic if and when that would help, as it did down in Egypt. It's really amazing how little change there was from the Bourbons to Napoleon and then back to the Bourbons again. Absolute power all the way through. It was in the invasion of Italy that Napoleon began his career of victories and first became famous. He launched his first Italian campaign in 1796 in the Alpine areas of northern Italy, Piedmont and Lombardy. There's Piedmont. This is a Wikipedia map, and you can see Italy sticking down there into the sea. The area in red is the Piedmont. The area in red here is Lombardy. It was in this general area, this very region, where the persecutions against the Waldenses and the Albigensians had been carried out. Northern Italy is crowded with rivers rushing down from the Alps. And that's why this is talking about rivers. There's so many rivers there. This is the very region where the persecutions against the Christians had taken place. In the times of the papal persecution, these river valleys had been made to flow with the blood of the saints. "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. As the bird meets her mate, so justice meets the wrongdoer." God often defers judgments to a later generation. It seemed to be a righteous retribution that these desolations of wars, these conflagrations, and these scenes of carnage should occur in that very land, at that it was now reddened again with the blood of men slain in battle for murders previously committed against the saints. Under the fifth seal, back in chapter 6, the altar was the covering tomb of the martyrs sacrificed in the cause of Christ. Here, the altar is heard speaking. Those murdered by papal Rome are fellow martyrs, associated in spirit, associated in place with the souls gathered under the same altar from the persecutions of pagan Rome. You can see on the map here the many, many rivers in this area. I believe these are the rivers that are being spoken of under this bowl. In 1796, at the age of 27, Napoleon marched his armies southward through Italy and humbled the Italian states and the Pope. Every river was made a battlefield, and every one of his conflicts was on these rivers. In 1797, the Rhine was subjected to France. The affected regions were all papal states and territories. All of them, papal states and territories. A blow to the papal power was struck from which Rome has never recovered. Sentiments were diffused by the flavor of liberty from papal authority that could never be fully suppressed again. That was the third bowl. Here's the fourth bowl in verses 8 and 9. This bowl was poured out upon the sun. The sun is the highest level of temporal authority, and there's going to be an intensification of the power of that sun and the eventually demise of that sun. The sun, the highest level of temporal authority. In 1799, the French Directory was overturned by a coup d'etat, and a government was established with Napoleon as first consul. The other two consuls did not have a right to veto anything that Napoleon wanted to do by their vote. So there was no restraint on him at this point. The power of the people was totally abrogated by a government which swept away every remnant of freedom. Napoleon lived in the Tuileries Palace. He engaged in the etiquette and splendors of a royal court. He suppressed the freedom of the press. He established a secret police. And suddenly, there was a despotic government under this very gifted man. From the time of Charlemagne, for 1,000 years, power had been invested in the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Charlemagne had been crowned by the Pope on December 25th, 800 AD. And every Holy Roman emperor since that time had gone to Rome and been crowned by the Pope. But rather than going to Rome for his coronation as emperor, as Charlemagne had done and as all the emperors of the West had done since Charlemagne's day, Napoleon summoned an old sick pope, Pius VII, to make the journey of 1,000 miles to Paris to crown Napoleon as emperor of the French. A pope had never been summoned this way in the history of the papacy. Napoleon met the Pope at the gate of Paris. Napoleon neither kneeled to receive a blessing, nor did he kiss the Pope's hand. And at Notre Dame Cathedral, on December 2nd, 1804, at the coronation ceremony, the museum director had produced a colorful imitation of Charlemagne's scepter. There was a lot of antiquity that was brought to bear in the symbolism of the occasion. Napoleon was robed in an antique imperial mantle. They were surrounded by cardinals, and the Pope was seated, waiting to do this crowning of the emperor, as had been done for 1,000 years. When the appointed instant had come, at the moment of the crowning, everyone was expecting Napoleon, who had never bowed the knee to anyone, to go and kneel before the so-called Holy Father. And when the Pope said, "Receive the imperial crown," Napoleon unexpectedly turned. He snatched the crown from the hands of the Pope, turned his back on the Pope and the altar, and in the sight of all France, Napoleon crowned himself. In this symbolic hour, Napoleon reduced to mockery the legitimate formalities that he was affecting to copy. The crowd gasped because the symbolism was clear to all. Napoleon has made a laughingstock of the Pope. Napoleon is saying, in essence, the Pope's not what he used to be. I have the Pope here to make the point that I don't need the Pope to make me emperor. Napoleon was instrumental in ending the German Confederation known as the Holy Roman Empire, starting in 1806 with the limitation of the authority of the Emperor Francis to his hereditary province of Austria. It wasn't long after that before the Holy Roman Empire was declared to not exist anymore. Within 2 years, most of the other once independent sovereignties of Western Europe were revolutionized, and their light was eclipsed in the political heaven. Napoleon was a kingmaker, and he loved his family. He made his brother Jerome the king of Westphalia, which is a region in Germany. He made his brother Louis the king of Holland. He made his brother Joseph the king of Spain and Portugal. He made his general Murat the king of Naples. He subverted old dynasties and created new ones. And Napoleon had big plans for the new world. People like Napoleon, they don't stop until they are stopped. They're like Hitler. He wasn't going to be stopped until he was stopped. Napoleon had already told his siblings which portions of the New World that he planned for various ones of them to rule. Remember, Napoleon once owned this land that we're sitting on right now. He had control of all of this. This belonged to France, which meant it belonged to Napoleon personally, as he understood the situation. Des Moines is a French name coming from the Des Moines River. Now, when Napoleon could see that he was going to lose this land, he sold it to Jefferson at a reduced price, on the theory that getting something is better than losing it for nothing. So it became the Louisiana Purchase. But at one time, he had big plans for where we are right now. Napoleon used artillery to an extent beyond all former example. The extreme carnage of the Napoleonic Wars included entire villages destroyed by burning. The destruction and distress which marked the countries through which the French army went were just almost indescribable. Dead bodies covered the roads. Half-consumed French soldiers were found in the ruins of the villages destroyed by the flames. Whole districts were entirely depopulated by disease. For a month after the trauma, when they had gone through, no living thing was to be met with except ravens feeding on corpses. This was, I believe, the scorching with fire of verse 8, and the searing by the intense heat of verse 9. After the Battle of the Pyramids, the Mamelukes called Napoleon the Sultan of Fire. The French themselves, victorious till 1812, suffered immensely from taxation and conscription and from Napoleon's very reckless way of making war, without supplies, often without hospitals, supporting himself by plunder as he went along. Napoleon told his people that it's better to die in glory at 30 fighting for me than it is to die at the old age of 70 with no glory at all. But not everybody agreed with that. He drained the lifeblood of the people, not for the defense of their country, but to carry the ravages of war to distant and unoffensive regions. Men were burnt with fire by the very sun that should have shed its beneficent rays upon them. Napoleon was definitely a military genius. There's no doubt about that, and I use the word genius thoughtfully there. Talent hits a bullseye that others can't hit. Genius hits a bullseye that others can't see, and there's an exponential difference. There's a zigzag streak of lightning in the brain, and Napoleon had it, and his achievements still dazzle. His achievements still amaze the world. In 8 years, he scorched every kingdom in Europe from Naples to Berlin and from Lisbon to Moscow. Ancient kingdoms withered before the intense blaze of his power. Like the sun, there was nothing hid from his great heat. Napoleon said we would not see his like again for 500 years, and we certainly hope not. Nevertheless, people refused to repent. It's true that France, wearied with the absurdity of its national atheism, nationally abandoned that atheism on the grounds of expediency, but they went back to the profession of Roman Catholicism again. The general spirit of infidelity in the nation was absolutely unchanged by this. And this was similar in Italy and Germany and Spain and Portugal. Roman superstition nationally, but French infidelity in the heart and a bitter, blasphemous, rebellious spirit. The fifth bowl in verses 10 and 11 was poured out upon the throne, thronos of the beast. And his kingdom was plunged into darkness. This must be subsequent to chapter 13, verse 2, where the dragon gives his throne to the beast. The throne of the beast is Rome, and the beast under its eighth head is the temporal power of the papacy. In 1797, Napoleon's general Berthier received orders to advance into the ecclesiastical states. The multitudes tumultuously demanded the overthrow of the papal authority. The French troops were invited to enter there. Upon entering Rome, the French troops began systematically pillaging the city. Church buildings, convents, palaces of the cardinals, and palaces of the nobility were laid waste. The spoiling of Rome by the French exceeded that was earlier carried out by the Goths and the Vandals, which we talked about in chapter 8. The Pope's temporal reign was declared to be at an end. In 1798, Pope Pius VI, over 80 years of age, was ordered to dispossess himself of all temporal authority. Refusing to do this, on February the 15th, 1798, this aged pope, while seated on his throne, was arrested. He was forcibly removed. He was dragged from the altar in his palace. Everything was ransacked and plundered. His ring, signifying his office as husband of the church, was torn from his finger, and he was carried off as a prisoner and died in exile at the age of 82 in Tuscany in August 1799. The Vatican was stripped down to its bare walls. Territorial possessions of the Roman Church and its monasteries were confiscated and declared to be national property. For the next several decades, the authority of the papal system progressively deteriorated. In 1848, Pope Pius IX had to flee from Rome again, being driven away. This fifth bull prediction was fulfilled in the events resulting from the French Revolution. Just as the crucifixion of Jesus triggered the action that led to the destruction of Jerusalem about 40 years later, so the French Revolution led to these fulfillments, pulled the trigger on all of this. This culminated in 1866 to 1870 in the Pope's complete and irreversible loss of temporal power. During the fourth bull, the legal status of the Roman Church was severely restricted. Many physical properties of the Church were confiscated, buildings destroyed, priests massacred. The wealth of the Vatican was either paid to France or later stolen by the military. They gnawed their tongues for pain in verse 10, indicating the severity of the sufferings here. The mention of their pains and their sores shows us the cumulative nature of these bowls of wrath being poured out, flung out as a priest would fling out the ashes or the coals from a fire. After the earlier sprinklings from each of the four preceding bowls, this fifth bowl had touched the throne of the beast now. And these judgments are cumulative, not just simply successive. This involved the confiscation of all territorial possessions of the church and monasteries, the pillage of the Pope's library and museum and furniture and jewels and robes. His robes were burnt to collect the gold in them. Roman Catholicism was recognized by Napoleon, but only on an equal footing with other so-called forms of Christianity. Napoleon's idea was to retain the Pope, but only in absolute submission to him, and to make a tool of the Pope for his own boundless ambition. He didn't want to abolish the Pope, he just wanted to control him and use his religious influence for his own purposes. The Pope excommunicated Napoleon, but in the Pope's powerlessness, this excommunication was met only with ridicule. The thing that was so feared for so long by so many kings of Europe, that the Pope might excommunicate me, therefore I've got to be under his thumb because he's got spiritual authority over me, was just laughed at by Napoleon. And this merely highlighted the fact, when he got excommunicated, that the days of papal supremacy were ending. The consuming and progressive judgment predicted in Daniel 7:25 was occurring. In the revolt at Rome in 1848 and 1849, the Pope had to flee from his capital. In 1860 and 1861, there was a second spoliation of most of Peter's patrimony. The Pope's dominion was limited at that time to Rome itself. And finally, in 1870, the temporal papal power fell completely, and Rome was declared to be the capital of the Kingdom of Italy, and the Pope had nothing to do with Rome anymore. All through the centuries, when a universal council was planned, all through the centuries, the kings of Europe would be invited to attend these universal Catholic councils. But when the First Vatican Council was planned, for the first time, the kings of Europe were not invited by the Vatican because they had rejected the Vatican. Probably they were not invited because the Pope knew that they would not come. The Roman Church did not want to suffer the further indignity of their refusing the invitation. And this implies that there were no longer Catholic crowns. It's a totally changed situation. In 1870, the temporal power of the papacy over the kingdoms of Roman Europe was ended. They no longer subjected the power of their kingdoms to the Pope. Garibaldi was the hero of the revolutions of 1848 and 1860. Garibaldi hated priests, said that they were a scourge on the Italian nation, and the papacy was a cancer. And now his dream was fulfilled and realized. The Kingdom of Italy was established with Victor Emmanuel as the king. At about this same time, in 1868, when Pope Pius IX was convoking the First Vatican Council, which was to declare the infallibility of the Pope, at this time, the bones of the martyrs were brought to light at the Quemadero in Madrid, as I read the other day. The words of the little horn, though, were greater than ever at this time, greater than they ever had been before. In 1854, the proclamation was made of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. This was a decree that was made. You are all now to believe this if you're in the Mother Church. The idea that Mary was conceived and born untainted by original sin. The Pope Pius IX wanted to be infallible all the time, but he had to settle for being infallible when he spoke ex cathedra in matters of faith and morals, spoke from the chair. They blasphemed the God of heaven, and this completed the doctrinal development that had been progressing for centuries toward the infallibility of the Pope. But he finally got that put in. Interestingly, when the decree of infallibility was made on July 18, 1870, arrangements had been made through mirrors around the Pope to reflect a glory of sunlight upon him so that he could shine in the presence of all the people as his infallibility was declared. By means of mirrors at noon, this was going to be done, but the sun didn't shine that day. Instead, a violent storm broke out over Rome, the sky was darkened, and the voices of the council were lost in the rolling thunder. The popes had kept the papal states medieval in character as much as they possibly could. And remember, the papal states stretched clear across Italy. The popes allowed, for instance, no railroad across the papal states. And this meant if you were a farmer in southern Italy and you wanted to sell your produce up north where you could get a better price, you'd have to put it on a railroad where you live, ship it up to the edge of the papal states, and then take it off the railroad, put it on ox carts to be hauled across the papal states, and then put it on another railroad to wherever it was going. This was irritating, it was unnecessary, and it was ridiculous, and obviously people were only going to put up with it for so long. Pope Pius IX was the last Pope King. He was the most important Pope in modern history. If you're interested in trying to organize in your mind anything about the history of the popes, I can suggest this little book, The Oxford Dictionary of the Popes. It gives a little vignette of each pope, just one or two pages at the most, sometimes just a little paragraph. It has all the popes from Peter, who they claim was the first pope, of course, clear on up to the pope that just retired and gave over to the one now called Francis. I've had to write him in. It would be current if the guy had stayed in office until he died, as I thought they were supposed to. But so it's a little out of date now, but they might have it updated. Anyway, I found this to be very helpful. We've been mentioning a number of popes the last couple of days or so, and if you want to know just a brief thumbnail sketch, of course you can do it with Wikipedia as well, but this is all by the same author and helps to put into sync. And it's really interesting to see the development over time of this function. This Pope Pius IX was a very religious man. He was Pope longer than anybody else has ever been Pope, for 32 years. But he was politically inept. He was the last Pope King, meaning the last Pope who was also a king. And by 1868, he had seen all of his dominions, with the exception of Rome and its immediate environs, annexed to this new kingdom of Italy. The French soldiers had said that they would leave Rome if the Pope was declared infallible. They went right ahead and made the infallibility decree anyway in 1870, and so the French troops left, and this is what allowed the city of Rome to be taken from the Pope. It led to an outbreak of anti-clericalism in Europe generally. On September 20th, 1870, the Italian forces came in and occupied Rome itself. Rome was declared to be the capital of the Kingdom of Italy. Rome became the residence and the seat of the government of Victor Emmanuel, and the next month it was incorporated by a plebiscite into the Italian state. And from that time forward, Pope Pius IX never set foot outside the Vatican again, calling himself the prisoner of the Vatican. And if you would like to read about this, I would recommend that book called Prisoner of the Vatican, which was very helpful to me in understanding this period of time. I don't think you can see it very well there, but you can see the title, by David Kurtzler. Very helpful in understanding this period of time. Pope Pius IX called himself the prisoner of the Vatican, and not only he, but for 59 years, no pope stepped outside of the Vatican. after 59 years after the taking of Rome away from them. They thought it was theirs. They didn't like that it was taken away from them. They would not set foot outside the Vatican for 59 years. No pope would enter Rome's church buildings. No pope would even escape the summer heat by retreating to the papal villa in the nearby hills. This was a pouting protest, because to travel beyond the little patch of land that remained under his control would mean acknowledging that the pope was no longer the prisoner of the Vatican. And that, for almost six decades, no pope was willing to do. It would have meant accepting the fact that everything had been taken from them but Vatican City. By staying in the Vatican, they were calling attention to their distress. They were waiting for somebody to come and reverse this ruling. They used to have Europe at their command. Isn't there somebody who's going to come in and reverse this? By the way, this had happened before, back in 1848. And so there was precedent for this. But this time, nobody came. And prisoner of the Vatican tells the whole story in considerable detail. When Pope Pius IX died in 1881, he had effectively and against his will created what you and I know of as the modern papacy. Stripped of its temporal dominion, he functioned without political power. He left the Catholic Church profoundly changed. During his funeral procession in 1881, an angry anti-clerical mob pelted the procession with rocks and threatened to throw the Pope's corpse into the Tiber River. It's sometimes said that modern Italy was founded over the dead body of Pope Pius IX. The greatest foe to the creation of modern Italy was the Pope. And when the Pope appears in public today, he still carries the staff representing his temporal authority, the same as he carries the cross representing his spiritual authority. He didn't give it up. It was taken from him. And Vatican City today, Vatican City today, I think literally and formally known as Vatican City State, is the smallest internationally recognized independent state in the world. And this is true both by area and by population. It is 110 acres, population 840. Farming people know what 110 acres is. Some of the rest of us may not. One square mile is 640 acres. One square half mile is 160 acres. So this is less, considerably less, 50 acres less than one square half mile. Ginger was telling me that on a normal average day when we're not around, she's at work, she'll go out at her lunch hour and run, I think she said, about 3.5 miles a day during her lunch hour. By doing that, she could run around this country, the Pope's country. She could run around it, I think, more than twice just in the few minutes that she runs. This is a country that you could walk across in just a few moments. 110 acres. It's a tiny little country. From all that he ruled, the Pope today is politically reduced to being the absolute monarch of a 110 acre country. Some of you probably own more land than the Pope does. Vatican City is an irregularly shaped country, but of 840 people live there. It's the approximate population of lots of little tiny towns in Iowa. No passport is needed to enter it. I haven't been there, but I'm told that a line painted on the asphalt marks the boundary between Rome and Vatican City State. The temporal dominion of Papal Rome has been consumed. The spiritual power of the papacy remains and will remain to the end. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, be destroyed with the brightness of the coming of the Lord. Verses 12 through 16 tell us about the sixth bowl, which resulted in the drying up of the Euphrates River. Just as a river flooding represents a conquering power from the vicinity of that river, just as the flooding indicates the overflowing of that power into other places, so the drying up of a river represents the fall of that power. We see this in Isaiah. We see it in Jeremiah. We're way past being able to turn back to the Old Testament for this information. But the Euphrates River was a major international boundary between the Middle East and the Near East, though the definition of both of those terms are really kind of fuzzy. But it was a major international boundary. Was there a 19th century empire that suffered this kind of a loss of of power or a fall at this time. Obviously, we're talking about the Ottoman Turkish Empire. It can't be anything else. The same Turkish power that was described under the sixth trumpet as burgeoning and taking over, as loosed from the Euphrates, is intended here in the drying up. Just as the Assyrian power in the Old Testament was providentially used to desolate Judah, so the Turkish power had been used to overflow against Greek Christendom. Here we're told that this symbolic river flood was to be dried up as the next great event after the outpouring of the fifth vial on the seat of the beast, that is, on Rome. The drying up of the Turkish power was a gradual process throughout the 19th century until its power in the Middle East was ultimately broken. After losing World War I, it was reduced to the boundaries of the present country that we know today as Turkey, obviously named after the Turks. Internal revolt against the Sultan in the Greek insurrection in 1820 is what precipitated all of this. That at length led to the Battle of Navarino in October 1827, in which Turkish and Egyptian fleets were defeated by Greek and British and French and Russian forces. The Turkish fleet was destroyed at that time, and then after that, things went downhill fast. From 1820 to 1897, Turkey lost Greece, Serbia, Moldavia, Wallachia, Morocco, Algeria, Egypt, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Bulgaria, and Crete. These all emerged as islands from the subsiding flood, as so-called Christian principalities or provinces. And the professedly Christian population in them became dominant in those areas. So the drying up continued on through this time. Long story short, on December 11th, 1917, the British General Allenby, with the help of the Bedouins, conquered Palestine and Damascus. This was the day, this specific day, was the day that he made his formal entry into Jerusalem as the conqueror of it. Allenby marched into Jerusalem celebrating the British conquest of the Ottoman Turks. Britain and France came to control the Middle East, which was subsequently partitioned pretty much as we know it right now. So the predicted drying up was fulfilled. The elimination of the Turkish Empire prepared the way, served to prepare the way, for the kings of the East, in verse 12. Several countries and kingdoms were established in the League of Nations partition of the Ottoman territories and the subsequent dissolution of the British Empire in the Middle East. Countries like Israel, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, maybe these are the kings of the East. When, as I said on day one, this prophecy is encrypted in such a way that when we look at unfulfilled portions of it, we see only vague sketches. Once it's fulfilled, it becomes a lot clearer. And when we're looking at a time less than a century ago, we're looking at a time almost within the lifetime of some of the people who are here. And if Audrey's here, it would be during her lifetime that some of these things that we're talking about. We don't yet have the clarity that the passing of time later provides. The three unclean spirits like frogs that are mentioned here all come from the same source, but each has a specific province. The unholy trinity of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet are the leading satanic characters from the little scroll. The unclean spirits' identification here of being like frogs may indicate their loquacious nature. More than once, I've been staying in a farmhouse at night, and the window's wide open in the hot summertime. There's a pond just a little ways away, and those frogs just croaking and croaking. It's so loud. I just lay there until the sun comes up and then get up. There's no sleep for me under those kind of circumstances. I've often slept right beside my wife. She's just sleeping so peacefully away, and I hear these frogs because they're so loud. I don't know if that's what's indicated here or not, but it may have something to do with it. It seems that each of the frog-like spirits reflects the character of its host. They are unclean in the sense that they are demonic. They promote ideologies that oppose God's word and that oppose God's people. In chapter 12, we saw Satan in the covering skin of a seven-headed dragon. The spirit from the mouth of the dragon suggests atheism, and this can be permutated into a lot of areas. Atheism, paganism, which has gods of a sort, existentialism, relativism, postmodernism, which rejects absolute truth, the so-called higher criticism of the Bible came, I believe, from this dragon spirit. Also included here could be Marxism, and perhaps you could say that even Islam in some kind of way would come from this pit. In chapter 9 we saw that it came from the pit, but maybe it would be under this particular spirit. The spirit from the mouth of the beast would focus on the Vatican, and the Vatican now, from Vatican II on, under Pope John the 23rd, has fostered the ecumenical spirit, which has led so many, many people in our time to feel that Roman Catholicism is not so bad. After all, they're not killing us anymore, and the further away we get in time from that persecution, and the less people look into that historically, they don't realize what it was that happened. That not only are they not killing us anymore, but now they're saying that us who are not in the Catholic Church might not even have to go to hell after all. This has had a huge impact on people during my lifetime. My Uncle Frank, great Uncle Frank, was a Roman Catholic. He was, as far as I know, the only Roman Catholic in my extended family. And there were a lot of people, great aunts, great uncles, all those kinds of people. We used to get into these little tiny country houses, and the air would be so thick with smoke from almost all of them smoking that you could hardly see from one side of the room to the other. But you could hear them talking. And I remember my Uncle Frank puffing away, 4 packs a day. He was thrilled with this ruling when I was a boy, because he was now no longer required to believe that everybody in our extended family was headed for hell but him. And he talked about this over and over again. It was such a relief to him. This spirit comes out of the mouth of the beast, and the mouth, of course, is in the head. The mouth of the eighth ruling head is the papacy. Today, the Pope is exalted among many, many Protestants as an exemplary representative of Christianity, in spite of what his church teaches and advocates. The false prophet is identified in chapter 19, verse 20, with the two-horned lambskin covered beast from the earth of Revelation 13. The spirit from the mouth of the false prophet points to the Roman Catholic priesthood. This is the chief agent and mouthpiece and supporter of the papal beast. I mentioned that medal from the days of Leo X and Martin V and Eugenius IV, I had examples of those on the screen, maybe that was yesterday, showing the Pope seated on a throne, attended by cardinals, some of whom are kneeling before him, with the caption, "Whom they create, they adore." They first make the Pope and then they bow down to him. They are of a subservient nature, a prime minister, ministerial nature to him. But Revelation 13:11 says that this beast speaks like a dragon, that is, as an agent of Satan. He arrogates to himself the distinction of being the appointed and necessary earthly mediator between God and man. This is the spirit of priestcraft. The spirit of priestcraft is distinct from and independent of the spirit of actual popery, though it is its natural and necessary ally. This spirit existed independently in the 4th and 5th centuries, preparing the way for the Antichrist that was to head the apostasy. And it's still his most effective instrument and supporter. The Jesuits, for example, as one example of a group of priests, were responsible for introducing both the futurist and the preterist views of the apocalypse, obscuring the real issues involved in this book we're studying. In 1833, Jesuit priests launched the Tractarian movement, designed to restore Catholic doctrine and practice in the Anglican churches of England. Remember, Henry VIII ended that, and now they were trying to bring it back, teaching that the events associated with the beast would occur as future end-time events. And as we all know, futurism has become the common evangelical teaching. The Left Behind series of books and movies are popular outcroppings of that. Some Roman Catholics now are also fostering the belief that a new European or world confederation will be headed up by the Pope. Malachi Martin, a Roman Catholic scholar, has written quite a lot about this, and if you haven't read his stuff, you may have heard him or seen him interviewed. The Jesuit-originated preterist interpretation, which identifies the beast with an ancient Roman emperor, has become attractive to many students of Revelation, largely in consequence of these Jesuit movements. The historicist understanding of Revelation has been abandoned by many, and this includes many in the mainstream, so-called, or institutional churches of Christ. Preterism dominates in their preacher training schools, and many of their commentaries are preterist. These unclean spirits, like frogs, act with a unity of effect, regardless of outward appearances. They play into each other's hands, even in the antagonism between the atheism of one and the superstition of the others. All of them oppose the true religion of the Bible. The Lord says in verse 15, "Behold, I come as a thief," speaking not of His nature, but of the nature of His coming. In the Old Testament, the watcher would see that the priests and Levites were awake when they were supposed to be. And that's the idea here. Watch. Behold, I come as a thief. The part about the field of Megiddo is an interesting thing. This is a battlefield 60 miles north of Jerusalem. It was a natural place for warfare, as warfare was at one time conducted. This was the site of Barak's victory over the Canaanites. It was the site of Gideon's victory over the Midianites. Josiah was killed up there. Napoleon called the field of Megiddo the greatest battlefield he had ever seen. Every major world power in ancient times fought at least one decisive battle here. Alexander the Great, the war between Syria and Egypt, and Rome herself fought here. So that the field of Megiddo became a symbol. Just like Waterloo is a symbol. When somebody says, well, you're going to meet your Waterloo, we know what they're talking about. Napoleon met his Waterloo at Waterloo, and that's how it became a symbol. So Megiddo has become a symbol. It's not that there's going to be an actual warfare there. Somebody said, and I believe this to be true, that if today's soldiers and their equipment were put on the field of Megiddo, they would have to be piled 24 miles high. I don't doubt that that's true. This world is armed to the teeth. This is a symbol of the conflict between truth and error. Finally, we come to the seventh bowl in verses 17 through 21. We have arrived at the last element of the last of the three major structural symbols of the book of Revelation. It's punctuated with a loud voice from God, from the throne, saying, "It is done. It is done." One can hardly imagine the amazing patience of God, but the end of His patience most certainly does and will come. Here we have an earthquake symbolizing the overthrow of political authority. This is the culminating event in a series of divine judgments. It's the message that the seven churches of Asia were wanting to hear when the revelation was given. That Rome and his little horn, introduced in Daniel 7, are going to fall and Christ is going to be the victor. Further explanation of this theme consumes the remainder of the book of Revelation. This final bowl, interestingly, is poured out on the air. We haven't had anything quite like this before. There's an earthquake unlike any that has ever occurred. The description in chapter 18 indicates the use of the great city, the term great city over and over again there, it seems to indicate that this is an empire that we're talking about. Chapter 17, verse 18, the harlot is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Chapter 14, verse 18, the wine cup is filled by Babylon, who made the nations drink. To drink the cup is an ancient idiomatic expression meaning to experience an awful destiny or judgment. If you drain the cup to its dregs, you get the full impact, the full brunt of this judgment. So we have hyperbolic or exaggerated imagery here. All kinds of things that are mentioned. And I'm gonna have to grudgingly allow you a 10-minute break at this point. Please come back.